to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. I'm a proud graduate of the California State University at Chico, class of 1989. When I attended there to major in geosciences, I lived in Paradise and commuted to Chico State. The home I lived in was one of the many thousand that are now mere ash and melted puddles of metal. As an alumnus, I get a magazine from the school called Chico Statements. The fall issue featured a cover showing California on fire with an air tanker dropping retardant on a charred landscape. The cover story, written by Ashley Gebb, was called The Rise of Megafires. The issue arrived in my mailbox on November 7th, the day before the disastrous campfire destroyed Paradise. Reading the cover story, I was fascinated by the work of Don Hankins. He teaches geography at Chico State and specializes in how fire affects landscapes. Hankins even teaches a course called Pyrogeography, in which he teaches students about the power of using fire responsibly to build more resilient and fire-resistant ecosystems and communities. Don joins us at Studio C in Chico, California. They call you a pyrogeographer. Could you explain exactly what that is?
The short answer that I like to tell people is that it's fire ecology with a human component. And the way that I think about that is that if we think about the world's ecosystems, many of the world's ecosystems where fire is a component, people have been part of those landscapes living with fire, using fire as a tool for many thousands of years in many places, and including here in North America. And that's the kind of end of the pyrogeography that I like to look at.
Well, of course, we just had the most devastating wildfire in my lifetime, certainly, and the worst one for our community of all time, the campfire that destroyed Paradise, Concow, many of the surrounding areas and the canyons there. It's just, it's been, you know, absolutely terrible. For you as a person studying this, as an academic, can you just kind of walk us through what it was like for you on the 8th when you first became aware of this fire and then when you realized this was going to be really bad?
For me, I became aware of the fire, I guess it was probably about 7 o'clock in the morning. My wife was on her way to work and she sent me a text saying that she saw a column of smoke coming up off of Highway 32. We live up in Forest Ranch, and so she was headed down to Chico to work. And she says, "Hey, is there a fire that you're aware of?" So I looked on Twitter and found that there was a fire start up in the Polga area that at that time, about a half hour beforehand, was about 10 acres as it was reported. So I went out and I looked to the east to see what the smoke was looking like. And sure enough, I could see a column. And I thought, well, okay, this fire is probably about, you know, maybe a couple hundred acres in size by this point based on the size of the column development. Went through, you know, dropping my kids off at school. And on the way back down the highway, I stopped at a few places to take some pictures, seeing this column really developing at that point. In fact, one place that I stopped at was a place that was photographed by Wieslander back in the 1930s, just in the area of Little Chico Creek Canyon. Stopped to take some pictures there. Column was really developing. And then I went down the hill further towards Chico. And as I looked back to the east, I could see fire on Sawmill Peak with large flames coming off about maybe 500 foot in length and area ignitions of about 100 acres at a time going up. And then I could see smoke starting to form across the West Branch of the Feather River, spreading into Paradise and Magalia at that point. So I made the decision to go home and pack up and start packing and informing the neighbors of what was happening and what fire behavior might look like that day for us living on Doe Mill Ridge.
So you live on Doe Mill Ridge, and a lot of our listeners are not going to be aware of this geography at all because they don't live in this area. So just to kind of give them a sense of the geography of the place, the fire started in east of Paradise, jumped a canyon in a lake area, the Concow Lake, and then jumped the west branch of the Feather River Canyon coming west to northwesterly. And then you live on the next ridge over past the next canyon. So there's like the Paradise Ridge sits nestled between two canyons. And then you are on the next ridge over, right?
That's correct.
So when did you start to become concerned that your neck of the woods might burn up?
I think when I saw a fire on Sawmill Peak, it became more realistic that something really bad was happening. And I wasn't necessarily afraid for my neighborhood at that point and where I live, but knowing that fire and the alignment of the winds was probably going to push it towards Doe Mill Ridge, at least at the southern end, at some point maybe that day, which by, about 5 o'clock that night, I think fire was starting to creep into the south end of Doe Mill Ridge.
And just to be clear, your house is okay, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we're fortunate where we live at to be out of harm's way.
Okay, let's back up a bit and go way back. When did you first really become interested in fire ecology as an area of study and obviously passion for you, something you're very interested in?
Right. I'm kind of laughing in my head as you're saying that, because in the elapsed time since the fire broke out, we found fire prevention posters that I did in kindergarten. So a fire has always been an interest of mine. But academically, I think I really started writing about it as an undergrad. Some of the first classes I took were about land management, conservation. And I remember one specific assignment where I was sent to a place along Poudre Creek down near UC Davis campus, where the professor said, go out, look at this piece of land and say how you would manage it. And I came across this paper a while back, looking through old papers that I had. And I said that I would burn that landscape and gave a list of reasons why fire should be the tool to use in that particular area that was actually part of the old channel for Poudre Creek as it was flowing into Davis.
You are a real proponent of prescribed burnings. And could you just tell us a bit about, because a lot of us may not be familiar with, what exactly is a prescribed burner? What do you feel is the real value of using fire as a tool to fight these mega fires?
Right. Well, so I personally divide the use of prescribed fire into a couple different categories. One is prescribed fire as the way that maybe agencies and land management agencies would use fire. And then there's also the cultural side, which is more maybe the indigenous side of fires, traditional cultural fires. I think both have a value within the landscape. Just in a short answer to your question, though, the prescribed fire component is really loosely being able to put fire on the ground to manage, steward the resources for hazard fuel reduction, habitat improvement, and a whole variety of other reasons. When I throw in the cultural side of it, that's where we start to think about, well, why would a certain area need to have fire put there? Why should fire be used there? And we think about various reasons, including maintenance of travel corridors, protection of home site areas, biodiversity maintenance, maybe improving water quality, those sorts of things all fit into that cultural lens. And if we think about the ecology of the plants that are living in that landscape, each one of them probably has some cultural tie, particularly when we think about indigenous cultures, to when, why, how, what, et cetera, fire should be used in that place. And for me, that's the kind of stuff that I'm looking at when I think about when and how we want to start using fire in any particular ecosystem in the local landscape or wherever it is that I'm working at.
I'd like to, when I was a kid growing up in Paradise, I was always told, and I've heard this from many people, now I live in Tehama County, but it's the same landscape of the canyons going up into the foothills and then up into the higher mountains in the Sierra Nevada and the Cascades here, is that I was always told as a kid that when the indigenous peoples were living here, Ishi's people, the Yahi, the Yana, the Maidu, the indigenous people would use fire regularly to clear out the canyons. And they would just tell me, yeah, the Indians used to burn all this out so that it was cleared. And then we came along and stopped doing that. Is it true that they really used fire as a tool to keep the brush cleared out from their hunting grounds?
Well, indigenous fire management practices or fire stewardship practices surely involve, as you're saying, people did go out historically and set fires to the landscape. And in some places of California, that even continues today. And there's even a lot of revitalization of that. But if we think about those historic contexts, surely people knew to protect their landscape from devastating fires to maintain resource patches of different age class structures so that you could have the diversity of resources close at hand. If we think about, say, chaparral, for instance, you know, why would chaparral have to be managed? Well, you may be thinking about berry production or stick production for baskets. Those are just some basic examples, but people historically had to steward those things in local landscape because that's where everything that was needed for living in that place came from. And so using fire as a tool was really important. And as settlers came in, they learned to utilize some of those same practices themselves. I often hear old ranching families talk about how their families had gone up into the high country, and as they were bringing livestock back down to the valley floor, they would set fires behind them in the fall to clear the landscape. And clearing the landscape is really just a very basic term that's used for setting fires to the land, usually in the early part of the rainy season, the fall months, which for us here in this region, as we know, just recently came into to the rainy season in the midst of the campfire, right? So that's something that people learned, and then slowly, based on policy and liability and other things that have come forward, we've gotten away from burning. But as I said, there's definitely a resurgence of those interests from local land management agencies. In fact, on my drive down the hill today, I noticed that the Plumas National Forest is doing a pile burn or maybe a prescribed burn over on some of their lands outside of the area of the campfire.
We're going to come back to prescribed burning in a bit, but I'd like to go back to these mega fires that we've had in the West, because the last couple of years have just been devastating. This summer, with the Carr fire in the Redding area, and then this fire in Butte County, the Tubbs fire last year in Santa Rosa, and the Thomas fire in Southern California. You know, I could keep going, but I won't. The four primary causes that I have come across in my own research and talking to experts, I'll go through them one at a time, and then you can address them. The first cause, of course, is that we've been in basically a decade of drought. And then the second cause is layered upon that. We have climate change, and because the average yearly temperatures, especially in California, according to NOAA data, has definitely risen, especially in the past 6 years, and that's adding further stress on vegetation that's already stressed from drought. So you've got that layer on top of that. And then you've got what we've been talking about, which is basically 150 years or so of fire suppression, whereas before, these, like you said, these fires were set deliberately and allowed to burn. So you had small fires constantly instead of stopping fires and suppressing them and then allowing them to have these conflagrations. And then finally, we have what's called the WUI, the wildland-urban interface, where we have towns like Paradise, people living in these places, like where you live, where folks are living in a landscape that is prone to fire. So could we go through those four things real quickly and just kind of get your comment on each one? First of all, you know, the role of drought and climate change.
So drought plays a really important role in terms of flammability, right? I mean, even seasonally, we think about when are things most likely to burn, right? So if we have enough moisture in vegetation, it's going to be more resistant to catching fire in the first place, depending on what kind of vegetation it is. But generally speaking, you know, if we think about the conditions of the landscape in California, despite having, you know, heavy rainfall in 1 year, we've had a prolonged drought, you know, that's been going on for more than a decade in California. And I think some of the stressors that we see in relationship to, say, the campfire is really a byproduct of that, where the vegetation is moisture stressed. It's gone for longer periods of time without moisture, and the moisture recovery in those plants is at a deficit. And so when you have a source of ignition, in this case seemingly you know, power infrastructure failure, then you know, you have the ability to have big fires happening, right? The second piece of that, I think if we're thinking about you know, the increase in temperatures, surely the increase in temperatures is a factor, because it's that then is going to increase the evapotranspiration rate of those plants and their wilting point and the moisture deficit time frame for that to occur is going to be shortened because of that increase in temperature. And what I would add to that is that, you know, our seasons for how long that drought is likely to happen are seeming to increase as well. And so our time frame for actually, I'll put it in the prescribed fire context, the time frame we have for doing prescribed burns is maybe getting shorter based on that availability of moisture within the landscape, what we call the fuel moisture deficit or differential, I should say, within that landscape.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Don Hankins. He teaches a course in pyrogeography at California State University, Chico. Stay with us. And we're back. I'm Dave Shlom, and this is Blue Dot. Let's continue our conversation with Don Hankins, the pyrogeographer, as we talk about the role of using fire to fight megafires. As you say, we can only do these prescribed burns during the early winter months when you can do it, or even some of the later winter months. But those winter months, those moisture months, are shrinking, and the fire season is growing, which makes it, you know, that envelope is getting a little bit thinner and thinner of that time frame for you to do the prescribed burns.
Yeah, it really requires knowing the landscape, knowing the vegetation, and being able to read it to see when it would be appropriate for fire to be introduced to a landscape and for maintenance or even for first-time entry with that fire. And that can be done even in the dry season, but the conditions have to be right. You know, you maybe don't want wind to be too high. You want your relative humidity to be at a certain level. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into setting a burn prescription.
I'm wondering what is the expertise level like for setting these prescribed burns? Are there enough people that really, you know, is there enough trained personnel, say within CAL FIRE, the National Forest Service, US Forest Service, enough people that really know how to do prescribed burning? Do we need more people that really know how to do this?
A need for it. For some of the agencies, they haven't been in the practice of doing prescribed burns for quite some time because of policy and you know the suppression component of it. There is a need to develop that expertise, and so there's training programs that are in place for building, you know, that expertise through the wildland firefighting lens, right? So we've got programs like the Training Exchange Program that's part of the Fire Learning Network that the Nature Conservancy does, where they host workshops for people to do these kind of trainings where they, you know, people can come in with basic wildland firefighting credentials and then learn assignments around prescribed burns. And we've done these projects here in Butte County and elsewhere in the state, and they're actually done nationally. With the intent of trying to increase the number of people who know how to do prescribed burns. Even on the cultural side, I would say that there's that need for increase of knowledge of people who understand fire, who can read the landscape, who know fire behavior and fire effects and all those different things. There's definitely a need all around for those kinds of learning opportunities. And that's the kind of thing that I, as a land steward, you know, locally with the CSU Chico Ecological Reserves and working with other partners, that's the kind of opportunities that I'm trying to develop for people.
Tell us a bit about that, the Big Chico Creek Ecological Reserve. Kind of describe for our listeners who wouldn't be familiar with it, where what kind of a place is it and what are some of the things you're doing with that?
Right. So the Big Chico Creek Ecological Reserve is one of the CSU Chico Ecological Reserves, along with the Butte Creek Ecological Preserve and as well as Eagle Lake. The Big Chico Creek Ecological Reserve is a 4,000-acre area of land, roughly, that straddles Big Chico Creek Canyon. It's about 5 miles of Big Chico Creek flows through the reserve, with Forest Ranch Ridge and Cohasset Ridge running north and south along the edges of it, roughly. And within the canyon country of the reserve are about 15 different vegetation communities, which include blue oak woodlands, valley oak woodlands, meadows, grasslands, various different species of shrubs, and conifer forests, etc. And so part of the management strategy that we have on the reserves is to utilize fire. And we've been successfully implementing the use of fire since about 2007 out there, mostly with the intent of changing the dynamics of vegetation from non-native to native species. So timing of fire is really important when we think about that, to say restore native grasses within, you know, the understory of some of these oak woodlands, as an example. We've been really successful in being able to show that increase.
And you mentioned that as one of the real benefits of this is that you're able to get rid of some of these invasive species while helping the native species come back, right?
That's right. Seasonal timing is really important, and fire is one of those tools that we're able to use for it. Not all species respond in that same way, so some of the species that we're trying to eradicate with fire may decrease but not completely disappear, so it may require that we come back in and do hand pulling or mowing or something to that effect, but we are seeing a definite increase in native species in many of the places that we are using fire. And a lot of that fire that we're doing is really focused on that front end of the rainy season in that time period, say from late September through November in the local landscape. And sometimes we do some burning in the spring, depending on the species that we're trying to get rid of or steward for. But generally, that's kind of our narrow window of opportunity.
Well, back to our list of four things. The idea of suppressing fires, just poor fuels management. You hear a lot of comments about, well, you know, this is because environmentalists have not allowed logging companies to go in and clean these areas out. All this regulation has kept us from being able to keep these areas cleaned out. Is that an unfair characterization?
I would definitely say it's not an accurate characterization at all. There's a lot of our local landscape that if you were to look at Google Earth, you could really see the magnitude of this kind of work that's happening, as you're saying, say manipulation through forestry practices or whatever of the landscape. And I don't think that alone is going to get us out of the problem that we're seeing with fire. Fire has to be part of that landscape. You could come in and thin the forest. You could utilize wildfires that have happened, but ultimately, fire has to be part of that landscape. And you know, what I'm saying is, if fire is going to be part of that landscape, you make a decision: is it going to be under our terms, where we're going out and setting fires intentionally, or are we waiting for the next source, be it lightning, or vehicle, or power infrastructure, whatever it is? Is it going to create that same type of landscape that's going to be resilient, or are we creating more of a problem?
And then finally, of course, the wildland urban interface, and Paradise is such a classic example of this. Can you just describe for our listeners who may be, you know, in other places, not familiar with Paradise at all, as we are, tell us about what kind of a place that was and why it was so prone to burn.
Well, so for those who aren't familiar with Paradise in the landscape, if you could imagine at the north end of the Sierras and the south end of the Southern Cascades, which is where this landscape is at, we've got volcanic mud flows that have come down and formed some of the ridges, including where Paradise is located at. And so these mud flows have eroded out in some areas with these really dramatic canyons. And then we've got the Sierra Nevada on the south and east side of that, which is over in the Concow area, which is a totally different landform, granitic formations versus mud flows. And so on the mud flows where Paradise Ridge is located, you've got sort of a flattened mesa that's kind of, I would say, maybe at an incline of about 11% if you kind of think about that gradient going down in the Sacramento Valley, and a broad area that was covered with a mix of vegetation ranging from grasses and oak woodlands through the mixed conifer forest. And that's the nature of what the natural vegetation of Paradise would have. And then people built houses in this area in what I would say is almost a very high density housing in amidst the forest. And I guess the situation that I see in relationship to Paradise and why it was vulnerable is that just one to two drainages over in the Feather River drainage, we've got this feature that's kind of like a big bathtub. If you could imagine something that's shaped like a funnel coming out of the north and east with the Feather River drainage. And if you take that funnel and put it through the Feather River Canyon, where Jarbo Gap is located at, we've got the situation where that funnel is pushing the winds down through this canyon and ultimately blowing it into the Concow Basin and into ultimately into Paradise, as we all learned, you know, during the campfire, really set up a situation where the alignment was just really unfortunate, but set up within the landscape to do the destruction that it did on, you know, beginning on the 8th of November.
It's almost like it had this just gigantic flamethrower pointed right at it, and it just needed ignition under the right conditions with the dry vegetation and then the high winds that we had. It was just the perfect storm.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, like I said, the alignment is a key factor on that. And if we think about where Jarbo Gap is at, you know, we're looking at the tip of the funnel and you know, the everything downwind of that is getting an accelerated wind flow behind it. You asked me earlier, you know, about what it was like that day for me at home. And, you know, I knew that the winds were supposed to be strong. They predicted strong winds in the foothills that the preceding day. And as the fire was raging through Concow and through Paradise and Butte Creek Canyon, where I was situated on Dome Hill Ridge, the winds weren't that strong at all. In fact, there were times of the day where there was absolutely no wind, and then it would eddy for a little bit and then die down again. Where, you know, elsewhere there were winds that were, you know, 40 miles an hour or above. In these other areas that are really in alignment with that funnel tip, like I was describing.
I'm going to ask a question that might seem very elementary to you, but has been asked of me many times. So I'd like to get your expert answer to this. Is that when people look at the images of Paradise and they see the destruction that fire wrought and the houses that are just literally turned to nothing? Where metal has been melted and concrete, you know, turned to just goo. And yet you see the trees still standing. Can you explain how is it that those, especially those like the ponderosa pine trees, how is it that the trees were able to survive, and have they, like, what extent of damage do you think they have? But why are the trees still there and all the homes are gone?
Well, so I have only been up to Paradise on the 10th. I was in Paradise on the 10th of November, and so it's been a while since I've been back up there. But on the 10th, what I did notice is, as you describe, a lot of the trees are still alive and standing. And part of it is, if we think about what the fuel itself was, a lot of the trees that are located in Paradise or on that ridge were mature trees. And what we noticed from a lot of wildfires is that the mature trees tend to survive the fires. That's something that really speaks a lot to the, I guess, the vulnerability of forests after we log them, let's say, and we've got young trees coming in, is that we lose some of that resiliency potentially. So a lot of the trees did survive, partially because of spacing between them and then the different species that were there. For instance, if we think about black oaks, at this time of year, the black oaks are shutting down for the winter, and so they're dropping their leaves, and the energy released from the fire is able to go through the canopy without being contained and trapped in the canopy, which would kill the leaves and you know, perhaps top kill the tree itself. And I'm not really that familiar with all the dynamics for say ponderosa pine and their seasonal fluctuations, but I do notice that during the later part of the fall and into the winter and into the early part of spring, their uptake of moisture decreases, and so they're less vulnerable to top kill during those times of the year as well. So those are all factors that kind of feed into it. I mean, really, the fuel is the houses and what's in the understory in this particular case.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll listen to more of my interview with Don Hankins. Don teaches a class called Pyrogeography at California State University, Chico. I'm Dave Shlom, and you're listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return to our conversation with Professor of Geography Don Hankins as we talk about the role of using fire to make landscapes more resilient in the era of megafires. If there were no homes, if there was no community of paradise, it was just a natural area with the vegetation that would be growing there, or perhaps a population that it had back when I first went there back in the early 60s, what would it look like, you think, in 10 or 20 years? Would it look pretty healthy?
Well, it kind of depends on what is being left behind up there in terms of how incident command and you know, other entities that are involved in the fire rehabilitation and cleanup, what they leave behind. I think if we leave the mature trees behind, those that survived, even those maybe with some fire scars on them, provided they're growing vigorously, I think that if it was just a natural landscape, what we would expect to see is that, you know, in the next year we would see a flush of grasses and forbs, and in time, maybe 10 years down the road, we start to see this emergence of shrubs, and in the absence of fire, you know, maybe even trees, younger trees, starting to come in and populate. And you know, perhaps a dense forest begin to emerge again in the absence of any, you know, future fires being used in that landscape. Certainly the landscape would recover, That's the one great thing that I notice about nature is that regardless of what we throw at it ourselves, nature seems to be able to recover pretty well from most of the things that we do.
Well, of course, it is a large community and many, many structures burned with all of the, you know, the toxic materials that were in them and everything. But if you could maybe give us your advice, what would be a way of getting Paradise to being a more fire resilient community in the future? And what would be some of the advice that you would give about how to make that landscape a safer place to live?
I think in terms of moving forward for Paradise, this is actually a conversation that I've had with a few people who I think will be part of that decision-making process. But I think that in the long run, what needs to happen is that people need to come together from that community and really envision what that looks like. Certainly, I have my own ideas of what that would look like. And I think that if given the chance, you know, we could all work together to shape what that looks like. My understanding at present is that maybe half the residents plan to move back to Paradise. So when I look at a map of Paradise, particularly a parcel map, I notice that there's lots of little, maybe quarter acre and half acre lots that are there. And I think, wow, you know, for that environment, it's really difficult to deal with the fire risk other than, say, through building codes and so forth. But if we're going to have houses situated in a place that's likely to see fire again at some future point, how could we change the density of houses to allow for fire to be part of that landscape safely? And I think that's something that's part of the national framework through fire-adapted communities and the fire-adapted communities. I think that if we kind of look at those principles of having infrastructure, houses, and a natural landscape, vegetated landscape, intermixed with itself, it really needs to be something that can withstand fire in the long run. And so maybe for Paradise, that includes looking at ways of having prescribed fire as part of the landscape to reduce fuel loads and maintain certain vegetation characteristics. Or trying to address it in other ways. But I think fire, we cannot build a community without thinking about what that fire might be in the future there.
So if you were, you know, if you could just wave your magic wand and have absolute power, what would be like a couple of things that you mentioned earlier, things that you would like to see done? What would be the top things that you would do if you could have total control over what happened for the rehabilitation of Paradise?
You know, I guess I always have the pipe dream of seeing fire on the landscape, seeing the liability risks change for our state and California, unlike the southeastern United States and elsewhere. We really have too much liability put on people who go out and set fires for the right reasons. And I think we need to shift that. So seeing some shift where landowners who want to protect their own properties are able to do the burning that's necessary for them to do, provided it's at the right times of the year and it's meeting, you know, certain ecological objectives. I think we should find a way to facilitate that. That would be number one in my mind. In terms of other aspects of it, I think we do need to think about the ways that people construct their homes in these areas. And so I think if we could, you know, provide some funding to use better materials that are more fire resistant. And there's a whole range of research that's been done in terms of structural ignitability. So we should be using that information as any kind of new building would take place in Paradise. And maybe that, you know, in terms of rebuilding comes at a subsidized cost. I don't know. In terms of other pieces of that, I'm kind of at a loss for thoughts on that at the moment, but surely they'll come to me after we're done talking.
Yeah, that's always the way it works, isn't it? Well, if you were to say, okay, what would be take the ideal piece of land that you were going to, if you could build a house up there, what would you construct it out of? And what would that piece of property look like in terms of size and how you utilize that space and make it as fire safe as you possibly could? What would the house be made out of? What kinds of extra precautions would you take?
Well, There's a lot of materials that I think in terms of home structure, and this is not my forte per se, but I am aware of things that seem to make sense. If we think about wood decks and wooden structures, things that are anything that's flammable, basically, that's going to be problematic in an area where fire is frequent. We know, if we use alternative, resources, maybe metal siding or stone, maybe those are better. And that's not to say that they're not likely to burn, because we're still using sticks to build with in a lot of cases. I mean, I when I did go through Paradise, I did notice cinder block framed houses where the blocks are still there, but the windows and the roof and everything else are gone. So that becomes challenging. We have to really focus on where embers land on houses, where they accumulate, and where they have the potential to start fires. So if we think about construction materials, maybe we're using steel framing. We're also minimizing say vents to sizes less than an eighth inch instead of quarter inch, which a lot of older homes have. Even into the 1990s. Those are the kind of things that we need to be thinking about. So, the types of materials. And then, windows that we use, I'm aware that there's a shift towards trying to go to three-pane windows instead of dual-pane as a way of absorbing some of that heat that comes from fire. So with a fire approaching with intense heat, you can have windows that might shatter because of that heat. And so the triple-pane windows would reduce that heat transfer. And so curtains and things like that are flammable on the inside of the house are less likely to have that thermal shift to cause them to ignite on the inside. They often say that the fires that burn houses down burn from the house from the inside out. And so we need to think about ways of minimizing that inside from catching in the first place.
Yeah, you never think about that until you see the behavior of a fire in a fire like this, that it's the embers getting inside the home that really that does the major damage. And then what about the land itself, your property, the things that are, from your point of view as an ecologist, what are some things that people need to do on their property to really make them as fire safe as possible and, also beautiful?
I think, our landscape has some really beautiful native plants in it. And unfortunately, people tend to like to use plants that aren't from this landscape. They're not adapted to the local, climate conditions. And I think that there becomes a problem with the amount of water that those plants are needing but the potential for invasion. So I think that first to start with using native plants as your landscaping, and then think about the types of materials that you use around it. A lot of people in their gardens like to use mulches and to help to retain the moisture and so forth, but those ultimately are also flammable. And so we have to think about how we where we place that material, how close it is to the structure. Those are some of the factors that I think about. And then I think, where is that located, the vegetation itself that we have in the landscape, how close is that in proximity to the house, and how is it arranged within the landscape? So I think it's possible to have, nice vegetation that's cultivated in some sense, cared for, but it needs to be strategically placed in a way that it minimizes the ability for that fire to spread through. So that might include limbing up manzanitas with dead branches underneath them to the president talked about raking, right? So we could think about, the need for cleaning up a little bit around houses, particularly as the dry season approaches. We that's something that's basic practice, is that you remove the fine debris, at least around that immediate zone around the house, so that embers coming in won't catch those on fire. And then as we think about the structure going out from the house, it's more open canopy that we have interspersed with shrubs and those sorts of things. But as I like to think about it around my own house, you know, how that zone that under California state law, we've got the resource code 4291, which requires homeowners to protect, create a zone around their house out to about 100 feet that's got reduced fuels. And so that's forest thinning. It's some zones that don't have any vegetation contact next to structure within 10 feet, et cetera. That 100-foot zone around my own house, I use as a way of dealing with that is doing a little bit of burning on my own, either raking and piling or you know, for myself, I do pile burn and do some broadcast burns. But that's not necessarily something that everybody should do, particularly if they don't know how to do it.
Well, a lot of people do, you know, and responsibly do, you know, dooryard burning in this area. I'd like to just go talk about your classes a little bit. For you, like, this has been such a huge and devastating event for our community, and you're going to have students in your classroom who've had to deal with this and or students from out of the area that are aware of it. What are some of the big takeaways as a teacher that you want going forward to give to your students?
As a teacher, what I think about for my students and the big things that I really want them to understand from my classes, not only from the campfire, but just in general around fire, is that fire is not all bad, and that if we think about why certain things like this happen, you know, in the context of the campfire or the car fire, you know, what are the choices that we have to change that outcome, you know, if it were to happen in the future, what could we be doing differently? And so some of the ways that I do that is to take students out in the field and teach them a little bit about prescribed burning, a little bit about fire behavior with through an applied lens. And so we actually go out and we do this ourselves. And so that helps to show them, you know, some fire effects and that not all fire is bad. But I also like to go back and point out to people that, look, if we think about Native people within the landscape, going back, you know, tens of thousands of years perhaps, fire has always been there, right? Through the last glacial maximum, et cetera, fire has always been the constant. And so people have had to learn to live with fire. And in the context of local Native people, that use of fire is what has made this landscape or had made it resilient to these kind of fires. Granted, when it's drier periods, you expect your fires to get a little larger. Even those that are set by Native people probably got larger as the seasons changed and came into drier periods. But then as wetter periods came around, then your fire sizes would decrease. Those are some of the basic things that show, look, there's hope. It's not all gloom and doom. There's lessons to be learned from the past that can help us into the future.
And are you hopeful that we're, you know, with events like this, as many as we've had in the last couple of years, that public officials and the public and all of us are starting to really take a harder look at this and to become more informed and to have a smarter approach toward wildfire and our wildfire interface, our wildland interfaces that we tend to live in? Are you hopeful about positive changes coming about after this?
I'm hopeful. I'm always hopeful. I think it would help to have more of our policymakers involved, coming out and actually seeing some of the good work that is happening on the landscape. And you know, I think about a lot of the rhetoric that's going on right now about forest thinning, and you know what's the truth to that versus what other models are out there. What has worked in the past, et cetera. I think we really need to have a more educated group of policymakers that are engaging in these topics and talking to more than you know, say, industry experts, but talk to practitioners on the ground, talk to residents who do the types of things that I'm talking about. Those are really important to help to guide what this looks like for the rest of us in the future.
For you, with your level of expertise, when you hear a lot of these discussions like we have heard in the last year about forest thinning and that, what are some of the big myths that you encounter when you hear that and you go, ah, that's not quite right?
Well, I think, you know, there's this idea that if we just come in and thin the forest, that all is going to be great. Well, when you thin the forest, you also open up light gaps where the residual fuels that are left on the ground dry out quicker throughout the seasons. And so if we think about that, it can't just be thinning alone. Thinning alone has done some great things. I know of places where I've seen very dense forests that say the Bureau of Land Management has come in and thinned out, and I see native grasses start to emerge right afterwards and a diversity of other plants. But when we add the fire component into it, particularly under prescribed fire conditions, then we're able to reduce the risk of fire, wildfire behavior, change the wildfire behavior potential by doing that. And also that increases some of the diversity within the landscape that helps to maintain the ecological diversity and biodiversity of that place while reducing the wildfire risk. And so I think that those are really important components that thinning alone is not going to achieve.
Lastly, we're about out of time, but before we go, you know, when you talk about the home where you live in the wildland urban interface, it's not very urban, I suppose, up in Forest Ranch, but what is it about that place that makes you love living there?
Well, so I'll say it this way. One, I love to be in nature because it allows me to see those changes that we see in the world. You know, I can see those seasonal shifts that we hear people talking about in terms of climate change predictions. I live that on a daily basis. Every time I wake up, I see something different and I take note of it. But the choice for me to live in Forest Ranch and in the wildland urban interface came down to this. I could live in Chico and I could face the risk of flooding. I could live in the mountains and face the risk of fire. I can't do very much about flooding. I can do something about fire.
Well, on that note, it's fighting fire with fire, as they say, isn't it?
That's right.
Professor Don Hankins, thank you so much. Professor of Geography at California State University, Chico. Really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks again to our guest, Don Hankins, professor in the Department of Geography and Planning at California State University, Chico. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can check out this and past episodes on our website, mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us at NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed through PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered by Sky Schofield. Wherever you are hearing this, I hope you will do whatever you can to support ongoing relief efforts from the campfire that has devastated so many in the community where this program is produced. You can find links for ways to help at our website, mynspr.org. Thank you, and for all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.